Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
And I'm Chef Daniel Orr.
If you put a hive in your backyard, the honey this year will be different than the honey next year due to the will of God. This many daffodils, that many tulips, and the proportions change every year.
That's Woody Drake of Brothers Drake Meadery. We visit that fiercely local meadery in Ohio to taste the many varieties of honey wine they make. And we have a special report from the folks at Harvest Public Media about what might be killing off all the bees. But first, here's Mia Partlow with a look at this week's news.
During President Obama's speech about the economy in his recent televised town hall meeting, he confronted farm subsidies. Under his proposed plan, farmers who make more than $250,000 in annual income will not be able to receive federally supported farm subsidies. Farm lobbyists like the National Farmers Union fiercely oppose the measure. They argue that limiting who gets farm subsidies will not save the government as much money as it anticipates and will hurt medium-sized farms more than corporate agribusiness. This week, GOP presidential candidate Tim Pawlenty also said that he would like to see federal subsidies for ethanol production phased out. This was an especially bold move because he made his comments in the middle of corn country, Iowa. Congress wants to balance the budget, but it might be doing so on the backs of babies. The Republican-backed plan includes a $500 million budget cut to the federal Women, Infants, and Children program, or WIC. Nutritionists, pediatricians, and other critics say that this budget cut is unwise because WIC reduces healthcare costs over the long term. Over the last three decades, WIC has expanded its care from 88,000 people in 1974 to over 9.1 million last year. And could Ronald McDonald be hanging up his floppy shoes and red wig? A group of healthcare professionals sure hope so. In a statement published in many national newspapers recently, they accused the fast food giant of using Ronald to appeal to kids in places, quote, informed parents and health professionals can't constantly monitor, from schools to libraries to the internet, unquote. This is not the first time he's been criticized. Last year, Corporate Accountability International called for his resignation, but to no avail. Get news updates like this all week long by following us on Twitter and liking us on Facebook. For Earth Eats, I'm Mia Partlow.
This week, we're joining forces with the folks at Harvest Public Media. Through a partnership with six radio stations across the Midwest, they explore stories about climate change, food safety, biofuels, and local food systems. You can read all their stories and see photos and watch videos on their website at harvestpublicmedia.org. Today, we ask them to tell us more about what's going on with the bees these days. Beginning in the fall of 2006, some beekeepers began reporting losses of as much as 90% of their hives. The bees simply disappeared. That's a big concern because these vital insects pollinate as much as one-third of all the food we eat. Some researchers suspect part of the problem is a relatively new class of pesticides we're using on food crops and in gardens and parks. Insecticides are meant to kill pests, after all. But the key question is, could the residue in pollen and nectar be hurting bees? Harvest Public Media's Kathleen Masterson visited some scientists testing a lab full of bees to find out.
College student Alice Broderson is running an experiment on bumblebees trapped in little capsules the size of the tip of a pinky finger. She works for researchers at the University of Minnesota studying the effects of pesticides on bees. Here, Broderson is training the bees that when they get a puff of floral-scented air, they should stick out their proboscis because they're about to get fed a tasty sugar solution.
You can tell that they smell something. They're just not quite. There she goes. You got one to respond there.
It's like a Pavlovian experiment for bees. Except there's another layer. Some of these bees are poisoned with different doses of pesticide. The goal is to see how it affects their memory and their learning. Broderson's testing a relatively new class of pesticides called neonicotinoids, or neonics, that came onto the market within the last decade or so. One of them is called clothianidin, which beekeepers have accused of killing bees. It's used in treating everything from agriculture crops to trees to fruits and vegetables. We'll come back to the lab in a minute. First, a bit about clothianidin. It was registered with the Environmental Protection Agency in 2003. The thing is, it was registered conditionally, which means the agency okayed its use, but requested that the company conduct and submit additional follow-up studies. Lots of pesticides get registered this way, says Brett Lorenzen, a lawyer from the Environmental Working Group.
I would say the legislative preference is to get the product into the market if it doesn't hurt people, and then if we find out that it hurts the environment, we address that on the follow-up.
The EPA is dealing with more than 100 applications a month, and they don't conduct their own research, but rely on existing studies when they review a pesticide application. With clothianidin, the EPA accepted the study that the maker, Bayer, submitted for its follow-up assessment, says entomologist Vera Krischik from the University of Minnesota.
Controversy erupted over how that study was done.
Basically, they set up different plots, some with poison plants and some with untreated plants. But Krischik says then they let the bees roam in both plots.
So then if you looked at the effects on the bees, you had no idea what they foraged on. So that created the controversy that is this data that was out there, did it show anything? Because the experimental design wasn't really getting at the question.
Bayer didn't respond to calls by the time this piece went to air. The EPA recently reclassified the Bayer study, moving it from acceptable to supplemental, which means they really don't have any data on the long-term effects of clothianidin on bees. In the meantime, they've required labels on the pesticide that forbid users from spraying it on crops when the plants are flowering. Don Brady of the EPA Scientific Assessment Department.
The issue here is that it's difficult to design a field study that we have confidence in will reflect what actually happens on the field. You have to have a number of conditions, like knowing where the bees have foraged, knowing what the bees have foraged on.
That's why Vera Krischik's lab is designing new studies.
When you poison 30 or 40 bees at a time and they're all in these little individual cups, and you start seeing them shake and die, it's really kind of sad.
Grad student Judy Wu is running an experiment trying to answer the key question. Can pollen or nectar with low traces of poison still affect bees if they eat enough of it? Earlier studies tested these pesticides by feeding bees tiny amounts of poison nectar. But that's not realistic, says Krischik.
That is a very small proportion of their whole gut. So we now want to say, well, is that really what's going to happen in nature? They're going to forage till they fill their gut up. And so they're going to be drinking more, probably of a lower concentration, because the higher concentrations probably are not that often found in the field.
Here in the lab, Wu is working with about 10 bees. Each is in an individual tiny cup, those little plastic containers you put salsa in at a Mexican restaurant. And she's poked a hole in the side to feed the bees. Using a pipette, she gives each a drop of poison doses of sugar solution. Some of the bees get regular sugar solution, so she can tell if the results are really from the poison or just from being annoyed about being trapped in a salsa container. After several minutes, some of the effects are starting to show.
See that cleaning behavior? That's what I was talking about earlier. Their hind legs kind of stroke their abdomen. Their front legs kind of touches the face a lot, like they're grooming themselves. So now she's really getting into the grooming.
Neonic pesticides work by mimicking natural insect neurotransmitters and then overwhelming the brain, leading to paralysis or death. But sometimes, like with the bee we watched, in lower doses it makes them writhe around or clean themselves fanatically. And when they run longer studies, where the bees get poison doses for several weeks, sometimes
they do weird behaviors that you would never see in a bee. They start to lay eggs on each other, the bumblebees, or they start to make honey pots on each other, or they start ripping up the substrate and making confetti and playing with it. Things you never see in a control. So there's obviously something going on.
These kinds of behaviors may not kill an individual bee right away, but it means they can't collect food or find their way back to the nest or help build the colony. That brings us to the trickiest part. They can measure how the bees react to eating pesticide-tainted food in the lab, but how much poison are bees actually munching on in the wild? That's why Krischik and her students are doing another experiment. They're growing plants in the greenhouse and outside during the summer and treating them with different neonic pesticides. Then they're gathering the pollen to measure just how much poison works its way into this bee food source. With everything from seed treatments to spraying and irrigating, neonic pesticides are definitely out in the environment. But, says Krischik, we still don't know how long they linger and if they're contributing to the disappearance of bees. There's a lot riding on finding out. Bees are responsible for pollinating about $15 billion worth of crops. But pesticides are likely only one piece of the puzzle.
It's not going to be one thing that is causing honeybee decline or causing bumblebee decline. It's habitat destruction, loss of food resources, poor quality food, loss of just the place to put your nest for a bumblebee, viruses, fungal diseases, We happen to be looking at the pesticide issue, but it's not to say that other issues aren't just as important.
Krystchuk is working with the EPA to have her lab certified. This means her research findings will be used in the agency's review of clothianidin and other pesticides in this class. I'm Kathleen Masterson, Harvest Public Media.
You can learn more about bees on our website, eartheats.org. And thanks to the folks at Harvest Public Media for this report. There are folks in Columbus, Ohio, who are especially invested in the health of bees to make their business run. They make mead, which is fermented honey and water. Heads up, wine lovers, they're hoping to convert you. Brothers Drake Meadery has been providing honey wine to Central Ohio since 2008, and they just recently moved to a new 3,000-square-foot facility in the Wineland Park neighborhood. Their philosophy is to use local ingredients and to sell to local people. So don't ask them to ship mead anywhere outside of the city of Columbus, because they just won't do it.
Welcome to our meadery.
Thanks, I'm happy to be here.
I stopped by the meadery near downtown and spoke with Oren Benari, the general manager, who was pouring us some samples, and the man responsible for crafting the tasty beverages.
My name is Woody Drake, and I make mead.
So you are one of the brothers Drake?
I am. I'm the good-looking one.
Where's the other one?
He's at work. He's got a day job, the poor guy.
Their meads are made with everything from orange peels to lavender and with spices like cinnamon, nutmeg, and cloves for their apple pie mead. But first things first, there are 5 different types of mead made at Brothers Drake. Your basic variety is made with only honey, water, and yeast. For metheglin, you add spices. Melomel is where you add fruits. A combination mead is a metheglin-melomel hybrid, where you add spices and fruits. And finally, a cider is where they use apple cider instead of water. The first mead they poured was an example of a melomel, their Testarossa.
This is my most favorite mead.
This is a dry red raspberry mead made with wildflower honey. This is one of the first meads that we ever made professionally, these many years ago. This one is real dry, and I think that's an important thing to point out. Most, if not all, the customers that walk in that don't have experience, what they expect is mead is very sweet, syrupy almost, typically because that's their experience.
That's really tasty. I love that. So if you could pair that with some food, what do you think?
This Testarossa goes very well with spicy food. It cuts down on the spice, and it just creates a really nice flavor, a really nice pairing.
Talk about the process of making mead.
Okay, that's a good. I'm glad you brought that up. First off, we categorically refuse to use sulfites. Cannot, shall not, have not, will not. Period. Sulfites are very damaging to mead, and they're not necessary. Honey is naturally antibiotic, whereas grape juice is very naturally probiotic. So you don't need it to stop wild yeast. So we don't use it. And I hate to, I really don't like to talk, I won't put any specifics, but when you open a bottle of mead that has sulfites in it, it will smell like burning sulfur. Like you remember in eighth grade, you burnt sulfur, smelled like a fart, right? That's not what I'm looking for.
Of course
when
not.
I open my bottles, that's not what I'm looking for. And in the grape wine production, and I'm nobody's grape wine manufacturer, but in the grape wine production, as I understand it, there's a lot more opportunity for that sulfur to come out. In our case, not so much. We don't have open tanks. Everything is closed, so it stays, and it ends up having a sulfurous aroma, which I find offensive. What you have here, this is our bergamot blue. So this is a combination mead. This has blueberries, and this has bergamot flower in it. So it is, this is the one I recommend when my customers come in and they're like, Woody, I know you don't eat meat, but I do. And I'm having steak tonight. This is what I point them toward. Or lasagna or like anything that's real heavy. This could stand up to anything. This bergamot blue.
Okay. I'm a meat eater, so we'll test this out. This is a little bit of a darker copper to it.
It's darker because it has blueberries in it instead of red raspberries, and they add more color.
And you can smell it.
Thank you.
Oh, that's delicious.
Thank you.
This mead is getting better every time I taste it. I usually only taste our current meads once a week, maybe once every 2 weeks. And mead ages so well. And this blueberry, this bergamot blue mead, is just aging beautifully.
Mead ages spectacularly, as a matter of fact. I've tasted mead that was older than me, and it is astounding. Mead ages the first 5 years very rapidly. And then after that, it's sort of a slow raise year by year after that forever.
We've got another one that's being poured. Before we get to this one, where does the honey come in the making process?
Honey starts in the very beginning. We start with local wildflower honey that we get from, there's a one person who's kind of our honey broker, because he knows all the people and he speaks beekeeper very well. The reasons we choose him, first off, his honey is astounding, just absolutely astounding. And second off, he's believes like we do in a low use of chemistry. And the way he talks about his bees is the way most people talk about their kids. You know, that's a good sign. He's a craftsman, and that means a lot to a person like me who's also a craftsman.
You say you use wildflower honey?
We do.
Could you use other types of honey to get different flavors in your mead?
Absolutely, and that's a good thing to point out. There is actually more variety in mead potential than there is in any other alcoholic beverage simply for that reason. Every honey is different. If you put a hive in your backyard, the honey this year will be different than the honey next year due to the will of God. This many daffodils, that many tulips, and the proportions change every year. Now in Ohio, the best variety really for fermenting is black locust. Every 3 or 4 years we'll get a good black locust harvest, and that's just melt in your mouth, kind of, oh my God, I just fell in love.
You can really tell the difference.
Time, I can, absolutely, but I'm a little bit crazy about honey, and I've been at it since 1994, and everywhere I go I always taste the honey. So I've got a lot of experience in tasting honey. So, and just like anything else, the more you do it, the more you know.
So now this one looks like you're run-of-your-mill white wine, but surely it's not.
This is a traditional mead made with Tupelo honey, which is one of the best honeys you can put your mind around, and then added that with American oak. And we aged it for a month on American oak staves, and this is the one that's going to make Chardonnay jealous.
I can smell the sweetness. This one is the one that has like the tingle in my mouth at the end, which reminds me the most of wine. I really like this, so.
Oaky and beautiful.
Well put. All right, so what's this one?
This is a mead called VO. This one, now we're moving more into the semi-sweet of our meads.
So it's vanilla beans and orange peel.
Absolutely. It's fermented with rooibos tea as well to give it a little bit of extra punch.
That
color.
That's mead. That's what I know as mead. That's delicious. I love it. You're right. It's a lot sweeter, and it has a fuller mouthfeel to it.
Mm-hmm.
So this next one is going to... It's apple pie. Is this going to taste like apple pie?
Yeah. Well, you taste it, and you tell us.
Oh, boy. Okay.
How about that?
A little bit. I taste the spiciness is the main thing that I get out of that. I really like it. It's like the VO, but spicier is what it feels like to me.
The best apples in Ohio come out right around Halloween. So right at that time every year we go get cider. There's no water in this recipe at all. It's just cider, pure cider, and it goes from being apples to fermenting within hours. And we bring it here, and we add honey to fortify it, and then cinnamon, nutmeg, and cloves to make it apple pie-like. And it takes a full year. Typically it comes out middle of September-ish. And so that is a gorgeous sweet mead, and it's astounding how fast it sells.
Well, it's really tasty. In fact, I'm going to have another sip. I love it. This is great.
Yeah, it's tasty, huh?
You're a local business, serving
Absolutely.
Local people,
Absolutely.
Using local ingredients.
Absolutely.
Is it easy in Columbus to do that? Hard to do it? What are the joys? What are the challenges?
Well, nothing valuable is easy. Nothing worthwhile, nothing. So no, it's not easy. We get calls fairly regularly from people who want us to mail it to them or whatever. And sometimes it's hard for them to understand our philosophy. But it's just wasteful. It's wasteful to send things unnecessarily. And there's lots of market here in Columbus.
In addition to that, some people ask us, well, what about growth? And to us, it's not only about becoming more profitable. Every time we buy honey locally, we're supporting the local economy. We're keeping our money where we live, where we eat, where we go to school, where we are. Every time we sell locally, it is people from our community that are buying from us. So again, we're keeping the money here. That doesn't mean that we're not going to open another meadery in another city if there's enough demand, and once we plan on it, where we will buy local from that city, we will employ local people, and we will sell local.
The idea being that down the road, when we're gray-bearded old men, we will have created a a local business that can operate nationwide. If you know, if there's demand for it, if there's demand in Austin, Texas, well, then you go to Texas and you get sagebrush honey and you get their wildflower honeys and things like that. You know, and if there's demand in San Francisco, you go there and you get avocado honey and orange blossom honey and maybe you make jasmine mead because there's jasmine all over that town and they love it. You know, it's what they like is what matters.
A big thanks to Woody Drake, Oren Benari, and all the folks at Brothers Drake Meadery. You can learn about mead on our website, where you can also join the discussion about local food and sustainable living taking place on our blog. Check us out online at eartheats.org.
Support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods Market and Deli. Information at bloomingfoods.coop.
Production support also comes from goodsforcooks.com, online at goodsforcooks.com.
Earth Eats is a production of WFIU Public Media. Thanks for listening. I'm Chef Daniel Orr.
And I'm Annie Corrigan. See you next time.